some surprise stuff came up for me this morning, and I had to spend a little time with that. So that's going to mean that I have to give you a few things, an hour's worth of work right after class to get you where I wanted to be right now. So what does that mean? Let me get the lighting right here. Nope, not that one. Is that okay for these slides anyway?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oops. Sorry, let me get this set. So your exams are graded, and I will be handing them back to you if you remind me with a few minutes left in class. I'll hand them back to you. Let me tell you a little bit about the exam and what to think about it, though, right now. What was I need to do? I need to turn this one off. Okay, so about the exam, the mean was, I believe, around 70. There were some grades, like a 99, I think. There's some nice grades up there. There's some grades that go a good bit lower. The real one thing I noticed in looking at some of the lower scores was that the problem set and workshop attendance for some of the lower scores was not where you'd want it to be. And I think that you should not be surprised. It's a problem-driven class. So if you're not putting in that kind of effort, you really have to expect to not do well on the exams. Where to go with that? So what I meant to do this morning that I didn't have a chance to do is I will post the solution set. We'll hand back the exams today. In Blackboard, you can find your score. You should just verify the score agrees with what you see in your exam. Sometimes it doesn't. If it doesn't, you let me know. I want you to spend some time looking through the solutions and your exam and understanding what went right, what went wrong. If you see an error, if you have any issues with the grading, then let me know. I will have on the website, if it's not now, it will be something, basically it's regrade requests. So the way I like to run it, which is driven a little bit by the fact that I've sometimes teach these really big classes, so I'm sorry if it comes off a little bit like that. So some of the support structure I have in place is a little bit less for you than it is for like Physics 113. What I ask, if you see an issue where you believe that the spirit of the grading, that the grading violates sort of the spirit of where we're trying to get, which is to have some reasonable guess as to what you understood in the problem based on the work that you're showing us, okay? And partial credit is a piece of that. If you see what you perceive to be a potential grading error, what I ask for you to do is don't just call me out of the blue or stop me in the hall or come up to me after class and say, you know, on number six, this da-da-da-da-da. I don't remember what number six was, honestly. I have to sit down and actually think about it, and I also have to sit and think and look at what you actually wrote and try to... Basically, I'll be happy to do that, but what I want you to do is to simply write on your test or on a piece of paper stapled to your test what it is you want me to look at, just the problem number. If you want to put some reasoning under that as to why you think you deserve more credit, fine. Feel free to do that. But in the end, what I'm going to do is to simply blank my mind, disregard any notes that are written on by the TA, and look at what you have written there and grade it myself. And I mean, it is true, sometimes my idea of what the partial credit should be will differ a little bit from the TA's. I will not knock your grade down, but I will give you points, unless I start getting a lot of frivolous requests, and then I will change that rule, and then you run a risk, okay? So that's all I ask. I ask that you don't do that unless you've actually sat and looked at the solution set and understood the problem and have thought about it, okay? That's all I really ask. Having said that, that offer is then open, period, okay? After the course, if you decide that you're a hairline, you know, you're 1 point shy of a certain grade that you'd like in the class, rather than just come whine to me, go look at your old exams. If you find something where you think the grading was maybe a little bit harsh, I'll be happy to look at it. If it adds a couple of points, it adds a couple of points. Okay? So there's no time limit to that. So that's about the regrading. If your grade is not where you would like it to be, then you need to take this opportunity to do some introspection and think about what's going on. I will post on the website something that, again, was designed a little bit for Physics 113, so sorry about that, but it actually is useful, and it is a troubleshooting guide. I found the first few times I was teaching these big classes, at about this stage, some students would be upset with their grades, and they would come in and talk to me, and I found I was going through the same set of questions with most of the students. You know, things like, well, tell me how you're studying. Are you doing the problem sets? Are you doing them with other people? Are you going to workshop? Are you just sitting there writing down things that everybody says, or are you actually engaging in the problems? And so there's a bit of a branch point, depending on what the answers are, as to what kind of advice I might be able to give. And so I actually wrote this up in this silly little online troubleshooting guide, which I think some of you might find useful. I'm not trying to circumvent you talking to me about these issues, but certainly you will find within this troubleshooting guide many of the things that you might want to be considering if you found that the grade wasn't what you thought it should be. Generally speaking, most of you are here because you should be. And so if your grade isn't where it should be, probably something's broken in how you're approaching the class, time management or something. I mean, here's a true story. I had a student come in once, wasn't doing as well as they would like in the class. I think they came to me before the final, and their grades were fairly abysmal in the class. And so I asked the question, how are you studying? And the honest answer was, well, I read every chapter. I thought, that's good. 7 times. Whoa, 7 times. Well, that's probably a bit much, but, you know, okay. So how's it going? How are you doing the problem sets? Oh, I don't really have time to do the problem sets if I'm going to read all the chapters 7 times. Okay? That one was an easy one. I said, how about reading every chapter maybe twice and then spend all your time doing problems and workshop problems and stuff? And, of course, their grade went way up. So think about what's going on, all right? And, you know, it could be that there are also, you know, very particular one-time-only things. I mean, if you didn't get any sleep, you know, if you found somebody new to go out on a date with and you decided not to study, I don't fault you for that. I hope you had a good time, you know, honestly. But you know, factor that in when you're thinking about it and understand that the way the syllabus is written, you do actually have one throwaway. But if you throw it away, you don't have a one throwaway anymore, okay? So now is the time to figure out what's broken and fix it, all right? All right, so what I owe you is the exams, which you'll get. I need to put up solutions, the troubleshooting guide, and the distribution, which I also have ready. I just got interrupted and couldn't get it on the web before class. Okay, any questions about any of that? Yes?
You said you're posting the grades on Blackboard for the new version that's in a different place for each class. Do you know for 142 where you put our grades?
They're in the Grade Center.
You have to create the link to Grade Center.
You can't see Grade Center?
Yeah, you have to create a link.
Oh, all right. I'll do that for you too. Sorry. Yeah. All right. I'll try to do that. Anything else? Yeah, that's a good one. Sorry about that. Yeah. So you do want to always check your grades or accurately put in the Blackboard. Anything else on this? Okay. So if you have a regrade request, just to finish that off, I will look at it. I will take my shot at what I think, okay? And I will then write a note on that exam. Now, this may not happen for a couple of weeks, so I'm going to give it a few days for requests to come in, okay? And then, like every other pile in my life, it may sit there for a few days before I get around to doing it. When I do it, I will put the exams in the box in the right folders, and I'll send you an email note, okay? If at that point you look at it and you really think I've missed something, that you disagree, I have no issues meeting with you. You know, just let me know, and we'll sit and we'll chat it out, okay? So, all right. So last time we started special relativity, and we talked a little bit about the nature of space and time, and where I hope we left it was that we all have this basic perception of space and time, which we're born with, certainly we develop in time because it works in the world in which we live, where we have these three immutable dimensions of space that basically move lockstep through time in one direction. And all of us perceive it the same way, regardless of our motion or what we're doing. This is different from a mental perception of time, because I'm sort of talking about the world of clocks and experiments. It is true that if I am boring, it will seem to go forever. Or, you know, if you go and do something really fun, it does go fast. So your mental perception of time is sort of a different thing, okay? And I'm not talking about that. But so if we're agreed on the three dimensions of space sliding through time in one dimension, in one direction, this is the worldview that is in Newtonian physics. In classical physics in general. So all of your perception of mechanics, if you go and you look at mechanics, this is the worldview that it's built on, okay, in Newton's world. So you should have a fairly highly developed sense of this, so it should be no surprise to you that velocities add. And this is, I mean, it's basically common sense. Newton's laws are common sense once you sort of realize and understand them. There are lots of places where things are a little bit subtle, right? If I push a box, it doesn't just go forever because there's the force of friction that you don't really think about all the time, but that's what stops it. Still, if you have ice on the floor and you push it, it just goes, right? So Newton's laws, a body in motion will continue in motion unless acted on by a force, really are the world in which we seem to live and what our intuition is based on. So velocities add, it's common sense. So if I'm walking and you have a radar gun and you measure my speed to be, I don't know, a couple miles per hour, 4 miles per hour, then if I'm walking and we're in an airport and there is a moving sidewalk at 2 miles per hour, and I'm walking along and I don't break stride and I'm now on the moving sidewalk and you measure my speed off to the side, you know, you'll find that it's 6 miles per hour, right? I mean, that's just the world in which we live. And you've all experienced it if you've been on moving sidewalks. I mean, it's half the fun. And if you don't really realize how much fun it is, you should just have kids sometime and try to make it through the airport. I mean, you turn around and they're walking the other way and running into people, and it's just, you know, it's sort of a shame we grow up sometimes. We sort of lose the joy of fun things like escalators. And any rate, now the trick is, if you now do this exact same experience, but now instead of using the velocity of me, for example, we use the velocity of the light coming out of this laser pointer. All right? What should the speed be? If we just say that the inherent speed of light, if I'm at rest with respect to you, is measured to be c, if I'm now in a car that's moving with some speed v in this direction, and I shine the light like that, what speed should you measure for the light? It really should be c plus v. That's the world in which we live, right? If you've ever, not that any of you would ever have done such a thing, but if you've ever gone out joyriding and, you know, you throw out the beer bottles to bash the mailboxes. I would never have done such a thing, I can assure you of that. But if you're going fast enough, it'll take out that mailbox because the beer bottle is moving, or the Coke bottle, whatever, is moving, okay, at the speed of the car, plus however you throw it, right? So the world is like that, okay? If you play football, you better think of additive velocities. If you're going to go out hunting, you better think of additive velocities. Otherwise, you haven't got a prayer of playing football. In fact, if you're going to drive and you don't know about additive velocities, I don't want to be anywhere near the road that you're on. Right? Some little old lady's going 5 miles an hour down the road, and you're doing 70 miles an hour coming up behind. You're catching up at 65 miles per hour, okay? Now, if you go and you say, okay, this is the way the world works, and I'm in a car and I shine light like that, and you now go and measure it, it turns out that whether I'm in the car going fast this way or I'm standing still with respect to you, you'll measure the same value. Whether I point it this way, or this way, if I'm moving like this, you'll measure the same value. Doesn't that bother you? The little old lady's going 5 miles an hour down the road if you're standing there watching her go, okay? Now you're in a sports car going at 80 miles an hour straight at her. She's still going at 5 miles an hour with respect to you, away from you. This is messed up. All right? So this was discovered in the 1880s, and it bothered people a lot. And as we will find, light is a wave phenomenon, and people understand waves very well, and waves move at fixed velocities in media. What kinds of waves? Waves on strings, waves in water, etc. All right? If light is a wave, it has to be the same sort of thing. If you're moving with respect to the medium, I mean, think about it. I throw a rock into a pond, the water waves move out. If I'm now running with the water waves, I can make them stay even with me. I can even go faster than them, right? So light should be the same way. Light moves through some ethereal medium because that's the way waves work, right? A wave on a string, as a piece of string moves up, it pulls another piece of string up, pulls another piece of string up. Even a wave in a stadium, right? What do? As it comes past, you stand up like this. There's a correlation between you and the timing of the person next to you. That's what makes the wave happen. So the medium is you, your perception, and everything is doing this. If you stand up at some random time, it doesn't work. Right? So light should be no different, really. So this is really screwed up, and people tried to save it. They did have a perception of light traveling through a medium, and this result is pretty strange. And so it did bother physicists. They struggled with it, and I'm not going to bother you too much with the history. But then Einstein comes along, and Einstein did what Einstein actually does really, really, really well. He certainly was a brilliant man, but if you look at a lot of what he did, the basic aspects of them are not so brilliant. They're actually sort of, well, duh. And one of them, in this case, was he said, well, perhaps these experiments are actually simply correct. As weird as it seems, let us assume that nature is telling us something. So one assumption that he makes is that the speed of light is constant, regardless of your point of view or your reference frame, your motion. Okay, so if you believe that, then you would say this has the same speed, that has the same speed, and this has the same speed when you measure it. Okay, that's the statement. The other thing he said, which is also a little bit of a duh moment, is the physics has to be the same regardless of your point of view. So if I drop an egg and it breaks, whether I am standing here at rest with respect to you or you're flying by in a jet aircraft, when you look at it, that egg was in my hand and then it gets broken. Okay, so some things you simply have to have be the same in all reference frames. So those are the two fundamental postulates of special relativity. And we're going to just take those postulates and then just pursue them for a minute to see where they go. So let us create an event that we can consider, and I want to do a sort of a thought experiment where the event is a ray of light goes from the bottom of like a truck that's flying by on the road. A ray of light is emitted, bounces off a mirror, and comes back. Okay, so that's basically the event. I guess I'll call it a train since I put train there. And you know, you can see through the side of the train and everything, so you can observe this. So that's a fact. The light was emitted and it is detected. So what I'd like to do is to look at this from two points of view. So from one point of view, let us suppose that it's always Sam and Sally in relativity problems. That's one of the little rules you need to understand. Okay, so it's always Sam and Sally. So Sam has a clock, and Sam has incredible reflexes. So when the light is emitted, Sam starts a stopwatch, and the light goes up and comes back down, and somehow Sam knows when it hits and stops the stopwatch. Now, of course, that's a pile of crap, but let's assume Sam is this really amazingly reflexive person or whatever. So what do we get out of this? Well, the velocity of light is c, because it is always c, no matter who you are. And, of course, velocity is distance over time. The distance is 2 times h. So if we were to ask what's the speed of light from Sam's point of view, it's 2h divided by the time he measures, right? Or the time is 2h over c. You all right with that? I hope so. Okay. So then we're going to look at the exact same phenomenon, but now we're going to assume it's in the eyes of Sally, and Sally is beside the tracks. Right, so the train is moving past Sally as this thing happens. So I'm not going to really tell you how, but Sally somehow knows right when the light is emitted and starts her stopwatch. And then in the time that the light moves at a finite speed up to the ceiling, from Sally's point of view, the train has actually moved. So we know that the light hits the mirror because that's a physical event that has to be the case in all reference frames. So Sally perceives this to be the path of the light, okay? And then, and the train moves a certain distance in that finite time because the train is moving at speed v. And then when the light comes back and hits the floor and she stops her stopwatch, the light hits right here. So Sally will perceive the path of the light to be this, okay? And she measures a time. And the speed of light that Sally measures then is going to be the time, is going to be this distance, this path distance, divided by the speed of light, which is always constant. So now you can sort of see where we're going. The height is unchanged, but just because they have a different point of view, Sam sees this, Sally sees this. Clearly, this path is longer than this path. If the speed is invariant, that means that the time must also be longer here than it is here. So time is not absolute. It depends on your point of view. It is relative. I hope that bothers you. Okay, I really do. Because we have just thrown out all of human intuition. Right? This is really whacked up. Right? It's just messed up. Okay. So we can get analytical, and that's where we're going to go with a lot of this. So if we assume that the train moves a distance, v of the train times the time that Sally measures, so that's going to be this total distance, that means this piece is one half of that. This is the distance h, so this is the hypotenuse of one half vt, the square of one half vt and the square of h summed. So this quantity, square root of that will give you this distance d. 2 times this d is going to be this total path length. Boy, that was an elegant way of explaining this slide, I thought. All right, so the c is the distance by time. That's 2d over Sally. So we can write down what that is in terms of the hypotenuse in d. And so what we find is, you know, remember, this is what we had for Sam. This is what we have for Sally. If I substitute in for D, it's 2 times that the hypotenuse length. And these C's, by construction from the start, have to be the same. So I can now set those equal to each other and then do a little bit of algebra to find Sally's time in terms of Sam's time. or vice versa. So we do a little bit of algebra, and this is like 8th grade, 7th grade algebra or something. You end up with Sally's time being this weird quantity times Sam's time. This weird quantity is made up, this velocity is the velocity of the train, or a way to think about that, it is the relative velocity of the two reference frames that we're comparing. All right? And the two reference frames are Sam's and Sally's, and so what we're doing is we're comparing how time is perceived in those two reference frames for the same event. And this is the mathematical formula that does that. This quantity is called gamma. And the reason why you don't need to adjust your clock depending on how fast you're going on your daily commute or whatever is because the form of this. If V is small compared to C, this term is zero, and you have 1 over the square root of 1, and it's 1, and that is the world in which we live, typically. Okay? The minute that you have something that is moving fast compared to speed, or a reasonable fraction of the speed of light, this becomes non-trivial. Okay, and then this becomes non-trivial, but it's always 1 minus something that V can't be as big as C. So this will always be less than 1, but it can be as close to 1 as you care to get it, depending on how fast you're going. So this quantity is less than 1. 1 divided by a quantity that's less than 1 is a non-zero greater than 1 quantity. And so if that happens, then Sally's time that she perceives is longer than what Sam measures by that gamma factor. Yes?
So this is assuming that we're using light as the wave function. Are there any other wave functions that we can... You said that the speed of light is the same no matter what.
All right, be careful. Wave function is quantum mechanics. This is relativity. But the wave, yeah. No, this is just for light.
Okay.
And to get ahead of us a little bit, it's because light is a wave phenomenon that can actually travel in a vacuum. And that makes it inherently different from any other wave except perhaps the waves we talk about in quantum mechanics. So mechanical waves fit additive velocities. Now, if you happen to have a mechanical wave that is going at a large fraction of the speed of light, you'll have to do relativistic corrections to whatever you see. But having said that, this whole thing is hinging on light. Light is special. Okay, so now, right, so can this be true? Yeah, I mean, this is really whacked, right? I mean, this is crazy. So you've got to go and you've got to measure things. And so, yes, people have taken very precise clocks, synchronized them, put one on an airplane and had it go and come back, and they have measured that the clock on the plane, the time will have traveled, less time will have traveled on the clock that goes on the plane. Because of the motion. It's a little more complex, as we'll get to, because there are also effects due to gravitation, so you have to think a little bit about to pull the answer, but yeah, it works quite well. We're constantly... You constantly have... subatomic particles passing through you. We call them cosmic rays. Cosmic rays come from interactions of particles coming from the sun and other astrophysical sources impinging on the top of the atmosphere. When they hit the atmosphere, they actually interact near the top of the atmosphere. When they do, they'll create particles, many of which are called muons. Muons, if I had a muon in my hand, I had a sample of 1,000 of them, what we would find is that the statistical lifetime of them is 1 microsecond. So it's a nuclear decay, so it drops off exponentially, but the lifetime that quantifies it is 1 microsecond. So that means within 1 microsecond, 1/E of them will have decayed. All right? So we understand the lifetime of the muon very well. If you take 1 microsecond, multiply it by the speed of the light from the top of the atmosphere, they will not reach Earth. And yet you put out a detector, you get muons all over the place. Whoa, how does this work? Well, the microsecond is in the frame of reference of the muon at rest. If the muon is going very, very fast, that time gets dilated, and depending on how fast the muon is going, in our reference frame, it actually can last much longer, and that's why muons can reach the surface of the Earth. Very well understood. We're constantly having to do relativistic corrections in anything that we do with fast particles. So all of these, and there's, you know, entire books of experiments that have been done that support relativity. So it turns out that it really does seem to work. It's worse, though, than what we have said, because it's not just time. It also has to do with perception of space. If we do our little train example, then we can send the light this way, and we can ask, what is perceived for the distance that this length of the train, for example? And you measure the speed of light, and you can play the same sort of game we just did. It's the same sort of seventh grade algebra. And what you find is that Sam perceives the length of the train to be a certain distance. Sally perceives it to actually be shorter than that, again, by a factor gamma. So length is also relative. If you take a baseball at rest, it's a sphere. If I have a hell of a throwing arm and I throw it at some large fraction of the speed of light, and as it passes by, you are somehow able to see its shape, you would see it look more like a pancake as it goes past you. The direction, along the direction of relative motion of the two reference frames, it gets contracted. So it's length contraction by a factor gamma. So it depends on how fast I throw it. All right, so space also is relative. In spite of the fact that we believe three dimensions to be immutable, they certainly aren't. Okay, so life is more complex because we don't just... We cooked up... I didn't go through the algebra for the second one, but these examples are cooked up to sort of isolate the time piece or the space piece in order to look at it. Life is actually more complex, because what you really want to do is to take an event that happens in one reference frame at some space and time, and you want to compare it to what is seen in another reference frame. So we have our two reference frames. The first one, the event is at rest, and we measured x, y, z, t. The second one is a reference frame moving with respect to the event, and it's x prime, y prime, z prime, t prime. In fact, the first frame doesn't really have to be at rest with respect to the event. I mean, it's just some event happens, and we can consider one frame sitting here and the other frame moving. And the real question is, how is the event characteristics measured in one reference frame, how are they related to the characteristics in the other reference frame? I guess we may derive these in a little while, but for now I'm not. So the real question is, how is x, y, z, t related to x prime, y prime, z prime, t prime? And the relationship is actually given here. This is the quantity gamma that we've seen already that gets large if the relative velocity is very large, but it is 1 if the relative velocity is small. V is the relative velocity of the two reference frames. X is a special direction. It's along the relative direction of motion. Y and Z are the transverse dimensions with respect to that. And what you'll notice is that the transformation is trivial for the transverse dimensions in space, but not for the one along the direction of motion, and it's not for time. In particular, what I'd like you to notice is that the position in one reference frame depends both on the position and the time in the other reference frame. All right? So the whole concept of simultaneity is a little bit strange, right? The word simultaneous has a very particular meaning in English to all of us. If you have two events, one over here and one over here, like two firecrackers go off, that can happen in a way that we would all feel as simultaneous, okay? If they are simultaneous to us, and they are at rest with respect to us, if somebody is coming by at a large fraction of the speed of light, they will not perceive them to be simultaneous. Why? Because they're in different positions. And the time as measured in that other reference frame depends both on the time that's measured here, which is the same in both cases, but the position is different. So simultaneity all of a sudden becomes a question of your relative motion as well, within limits. Relativity does not violate causality. So if events, the event ordering will not change, if the if light could have traveled from one point to the other before the second event happened. If you have one event, if you're in a reference frame and we have one event and another event, and they happen close enough in time that light could have traveled from one to the other so that in principle we could have had causality, then regardless of how you are moving, you will never actually reorder those two events in terms of, there's no reference frame where that works. So causality is preserved, but simultaneity is a completely relative thing, okay? The other thing to get out of this, and I probably have some silly slides trying to show this. I sometimes use these to talk to students who don't know. I mean, it's important for science, right? The whole point of science is to make measurements, and you really need to be able to relate them between different reference frames. So this really is at the core of what science is all about. So, but anyway, having said that, the other thing I want you to notice is, in these Lorentz transformations, space and time just get mixed up. They are not independent. So that is why you hear physicists stop talking about just space or just time, because those are not absolute quantities. It's space-time. Because what time or what distance you're talking about really depends on your relative motion, and they all get mixed up in these Lorentz transformations. Okay? Yes? It's moving just in the x direction, the way I've drawn this, and that's what leads to these very particular transformations. That is, the direction of relative motion has this particular transformation, and the transverse dimensions are unaffected. So what you have is a length contraction relative, I mean, if something's moving very fast, you would perceive it to be squashed in the direction of motion, but not transversely. So that's why the baseball turns into a pancake. Okay, so it doesn't stop here. I mean, once you say I could observe something, an event happening in a certain space, a certain place, and a certain time, you can, of course, measure other things, right? You can measure energies and forces and momenta and any other observable. And we may do this in a bit more detail, but for the moment, let's leave it like this. These other things have to have relativistic transformations. And what happens is in these transformations, you basically are transforming four quantities. In this case, for space-time, you're transforming the three spatial dimensions and time. And when you do that, they get mixed up in the transformations. The same thing is true for energy and momentum. If you take energy and momentum, you can construct, we call them four vectors. That is a vector of three. Instead of three quantities, it's a vector of four quantities. And the energy and momentum will transform in exactly the same form, where the momentum components, that would be like px, so this would be px prime, this would be v, and that would be energy. And, of course, momentum contains mass, rest mass is a piece of it, and energy gets thrown into these transformation equations. So if you actually look at the situation, once you've done these transformation equations, and you look at the situation where the mass isn't moving, what you find is Einstein's equation equals mc squared. So what comes out of that is a statement that, well, energy can take all sorts of forms, right? We already know that. You can have kinetic energy and potential energy of different sorts. Mass, rest mass in and of itself is like a form of potential energy. It is a form of energy, and the relationship is given here. And of course that's very important for all of modern physics. So this is a very quick little introduction, and we're going to get a little bit more formal now. But any questions? Yep.
If you have something
If it is moving at some arbitrary angle, you simply take the problem and rotate it to where one of the axes is going in that direction, and then you do your transformations. So you do a you would rotate your reference frame. So you do it. You would do a transformation in angle space. Then you would do your Lorentz transformation, and then you would transform back. But the answer is yes. If it's at some arbitrary angle, then you would perceive some change in each of the three spatial dimensions, because they all would have a component of that piece along the direction of motion. But mechanically, to solve that, analytically, you would do the mathematical rotation and then come back. So when you write your computer programs looking at Lorentz boosts, that's what you'll have to do. Not that you'll do that for a piece of this class, but that's mechanically what you do. You would break that into a full-blown unitary rotation of the spatial coordinates. Do your Lorentz transformation in a frame where you can make sense of it, and then take those coordinates and rotate them back. Yes?
How do you account for if an object's accelerating?
Oh, I haven't said anything about acceleration yet.
Don't.
We'll get there. But when you do that, you get general relativity. Yes?
For the gamma function, as your velocity moves toward the speed of light, then the final time is going to go to infinity. So does that mean that to an observer standing still, it looks like that object is also standing still?
I think I missed something. Say it again.
So as your velocity...
As your velocity approaches the speed of light.
Then the final time will approach infinity. So
yes.
Does it look like that thing is standing still, even though it's moving?
Right. So, you're... Anything gamma basically will go to infinity as you so you'll actually reach a limit. You cannot actually reach the speed of light. It's an asymptotic thing. Why? Because it takes infinite energy to do that, for example. But yes, you could effectively slow time. If an object went zipping by at some really close fraction of the speed of light, or almost the full speed of light, we would effectively see time standing still on that object. Right? That's what we would measure. So there is... I'm paying a little bit for not having had the hour before class that I was counting on, so sorry about that. Let me... think for a moment. Give me just a minute, because I have a slide that I normally have put in by now, but apparently didn't put in because the stuff I picked up wasn't quite right. So, all right. When I didn't bring it. All right, so I'll have to tell you verbally. Suppose that we have here's Earth, and we've got somebody sitting here, and they are looking through a telescope, and they see the spaceship zipping along, okay? And let's say that they see on the spaceship blue balloons go up in the window with "It's a Boy" on it, all right? And so we have "It's a Boy," and the person on the planet writes down the time and date when they see this. And let us say that this spaceship is moving at 98 percent the speed of light. Okay? And so the spaceship goes, and people on Earth have super powerful telescopes, and let us not worry too much about the fact that it takes light time to reach the telescope. But let's say that the person on the spacecraft lives for 70 years, a normal lifespan for a human insofar as you can have a normal lifespan stuck on a spaceship, okay? So they live for 70 years, it's normal, everything happens normally, and then all of a sudden they keel over and die on the spaceship 70 years later. And when that happens, then the black balloons show up at the wake, and the person on Earth records the time, all right? There is a special reference frame. The special reference, so this is the fundamental relationship, but which is the prime frame? I haven't even defined that for you. There is one special frame in every problem, and that is the frame where the event is at rest. In this case, the frame where the event is at rest is on the spaceship. What is the event? Person's born, person dies. The person's at rest with respect to the spaceship the whole time. So that's where, and we call that frame where it is at rest the proper frame. Okay? And we have time dilation with respect to that. That is the frame where the event is the shortest. If you measure that event from any other reference frame, you will be in a reference frame where that event is moving with respect to you. And you will measure that time to be longer. And you will measure it to be longer by the factor gamma. If this spaceship is moving at 98% the speed of light, the factor of gamma, when you calculate it, is a factor of 5. So 70 years will have passed on the spacecraft. And on Earth, 350 years will have passed. Okay? Or not okay? I mean, that's what it's telling us. So time travel is actually quite a possibility. All you need to do is have a spaceship that can go a large fraction of the speed of light. And then I can take you into the future on Earth easily, right? You just go off for a while, and when you come back, I mean, depending on how fast you went and how long you were gone, everybody you knew will have been dead, and you'll be meeting their great-grandchildren or something when you arrive back. The person on the spacecraft, everything seems normal and is normal. The same is true on Earth. You only get this weirdness when you are communicating between the two reference frames. Yes? You have a question?
Yeah, about the communication between the two reference frames. So when you got the person observing people in the spacecraft, the lifetime, what if the people in the spacecraft were observing the lifetime of people on Earth? It should be...
So from their point of view...
Yeah, and let's say like...
The Earth is moving,
yeah,
and they would perceive it the other way.
So the 350 years on Earth have passed faster than the 70 years on the ship, to the people on the ship?
If you were to ask... What is the standard lifetime of a person on Earth, what, to the perception of the people on the spacecraft, they would see it be 350 years. That's how they would perceive it.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's weird. And I think there's nothing... In this example, the way I've set it up, you actually have no acceleration happening. I mean, it's just... you might be able to resolve that conflict somewhat by actually taking into account the time it takes for the light to travel, which I'm sort of glossing over right here, and I'd have to sit and think about that. But for example, if this thing's moving at 98% the speed of light, then in 70 years it's a long ways away, right? And so it takes that light a long time to reach. So if you really wanted to compare measurements, you probably have to get a little bit more complex than this, and I'm glossing over that. Where you often see this is something called the twin paradox, where you say, okay, two twins are born, one is put on a spacecraft and the other sits at Earth, and this one then goes away and then comes back. Because this one's going away, they age much less than the one on Earth, and then when they get back, they come and their doddering old twin, you know, shakes their hand, but they've only aged a year or something like that. So that basically works. But then if you look at it from the other point of view, you put me on a spaceship, and then I see Earth go off at some large fraction of the speed of light and then come back. So that means I should be the doddering old fool on the spacecraft, right, and should be shaking hands with the young person on Earth. So that is a called the twin paradox. And the problem with the twin paradox is that it involves acceleration, which changes the problem. It violates special relativity, right? You have to accelerate up to the large fraction of speed of light. You have to then accelerate, turn around, and come back, right? So that's a totally different problem. I think to worry about the paradox here, we have to also worry about the actual time it takes for the light to travel and things like that. But I haven't actually bothered to work that out. Yes?
What if you had, say, two spaceships traveling, like, past each other, both at a significant fraction of the speed of light? How would they perceive each other?
I'll let you figure it out in your homework problems. So, I would hate to ruin the fun for you. So let's get into some slightly more analytical point of view, okay? So let's suppose we have this clock that's at rest in S, and we have the reference frame S prime moving at speed V. We've already seen this relationship. You see already, last page, this page, last page, I put the prime over here, this page, I put it over here. That's because it doesn't matter, right? You're just defining one of the reference frame to be prime and one not. And do not fall into the trap of saying, oh, I'll call this prime, therefore it's equal to gamma times the unprime one. It depends on which one you call the prime as to whether that works or not. The rule to remember is that there is one special frame that is the proper frame, which is where the event is at rest. In this case, the event is the clock. If the clock is at rest, that is the shortest time, and any time measured from any other reference frame will be diluted, will be dilated with respect to that, which means will be longer. Okay? So therefore, this is the proper frame. It gets multiplied by something greater than one, so this number is bigger. That's the way to remember it. If we do things in, if we worry about space, then it's the other way around. You have length contraction. That is in the proper frame. That is in the frame where Einstein is at rest, or the meter stick is at rest. Okay, that is where it will be the longest along the direction of motion. And you have length contraction outside of that, which means that this is the proper frame because you're dividing by gamma here. All right, to give you something shorter. So those are the rules to remember for simple length contraction and time dilation problems. You can get more complex, as we've already seen, but let's look for a moment at what we expect to see in Galilean physics, which is sort of classical physics as we know it. So imagine here's frame S, here's frame S prime, here's the origin in S, origin in O prime. S is moving at speed V, so this distance is VT in frame S if we wait time T past when it traveled past the origin. And here's a distance X. So we have some event happening, and that event happens at XYZT in frame S. So here is X, okay? Here is X prime, which is the distance it is perceived to happen in the S prime frame. Okay? And we're going to assume the overlap happens at t equals 0. So in Galilean physics, the distance here, x prime, is equal to this total distance minus vt. So that you're used to, right? That just makes common sense, I hope. Transversely, nothing gets changed. So this weirdness about how the transverse dimensions don't really change in terms of how they're perceived from the two reference frames is also true in Newtonian physics. Okay, and this is Newtonian physics. T prime is equal to T. So in relativity, things look a little different. X prime is the length as measured at rest in S prime, right? In S, this X prime is going to look shorter. So if you ask, what is the distance measured in S prime from the point of view of S, you'll find that it is shortened by a factor of gamma because of length contraction. So if you call this distance d, for example, and I forget why I had to change variables, but you call this distance d as perceived in S from this measurement in x prime is this x prime over gamma. So x prime is d gamma. D is equal to x minus vt. That's actually the same formula we had for Galilean transformations, but now because we're asking how is it perceived in S and this distance is different, we have to put in that difference. So that's the derivation of the Lorentz transformation equation for space along the line of motion. Okay? And I don't know, I'm throwing this out there. It takes quite a while to draw it, so that's why I'm doing it this way. I don't want to spend 3 weeks on this. But you'll want to just spend some time looking through these slides. If I now ask how does this work from the other direction, you basically go through the same logic. It can be a little bit confusing because you have to be thinking whether you're in S or S prime and what you're actually looking at. But when you do the transformation, you'll find nothing has changed except the plus sign here. So in this case, I'm looking at what do things look like in X given quantities in X prime. Or S prime. All right. So this is sort of looking at it from the other point of view. So from this point of view, S prime is at rest and S is moving this way at velocity V. And that ends up just throwing in a different sign here. So you're going to find this a little confusing in some of these problems because you'll be having to figure out whether to put a plus or minus sign here. Relativity problems can be a bear. Okay, so if I take these two formulas that we just derived, and you can then do some algebra to try to find the time in terms of prime quantities or the time prime time in terms of normal quantities. This algebra is a bit painful enough. I didn't even want to write it out. I mean, it's sort of, but you can find it in textbooks if you want to look. I don't remember whether it's in your textbook or not, but. When you do this, you can actually find these two relationships. Again, you have the difference of the sign here. But these then are the other. So basically, those are the four Lorentz transformation equations that you've seen. Sorry, I'm trying to think about what I can and should do in the time I have remaining. Let me do this. Okay, so let's imagine that we have frame S And we have the other frame, S prime, which is moving at a velocity v with respect to S. And now let us suppose that we have some object that is moving with some velocity, which I'll call u, which this is a three-vector velocity in S. Okay, so you're the observer in S, see something moving at speed u in some arbitrary direction. All right. So then the question is, we know in S, so for example, we know that u in the x component is dx over dt, u in the y is dy over dt, and u in the z is equal to dz over dt. Okay? Now let's look at what we see if we are asking, what is the velocity component of this object as measured in the S prime system? Well, I know how to define velocity in the S prime system. That is dx prime over dt prime, right? What I have are the dx's and dt's in the unprime system. So I can write dx prime and dt prime in terms of their unprimed components, gamma dx minus v dt for the x piece, and gamma dt minus v over c squared dx. So are you okay with that? Because remember, we have the x prime is gamma x minus vt. If I have dx prime, it's going to be gamma dx minus v dt. Right? So that's the x piece. The t piece, t is gamma t prime plus v over c squared x prime. So dt is going to be, we're going the other way. dt prime is gamma dt minus v over c squared dx. So I'm simply going to use that substitution, okay? And then I'll divide out by dt. So this is gamma times dx over dt minus v over gamma times 1 minus v over c squared dx over dt. This quantity is u in the x. This quantity is u in the x. So u in the x prime is equal to gamma times u in the x minus v over gamma times 1 minus v over c squared u in the x. So it's a sort of more complicated sort of beast than just simple, than the simple transformation of momentum and energy or space and time. We can do the same thing looking at the y. So u in the y prime is equal to dy prime over dt. But y is now one of these transverse dimensions. So its transformation is different. So dy prime is just dy, and dt prime is just like what we've seen. So this is dy over dt over gamma times 1 minus v over c squared dx over dt. And note that this is the time transformation involves the x, not the y. Right? So this is u in the x, and that's u in the y. So the transverse velocity transformations, u in the y prime, is equal to u and the y divided by gamma 1 minus u and the x, v over c squared. And u and the z prime is equal to u and the z divided by gamma times 1 minus u in the x, v over c squared. So those are the transverse velocity transformations. Pretty strange, huh? So to answer your question about you have two ships moving each 75% the speed of light moving toward each other, the way to do that problem is to put yourself in a rest frame of one of them and then ask, what is the velocity of this object, which is, let's see, you ask, what is its velocity if in this reference frame it's moving at 75? So you can use these relative velocity transformations to sort of work it out. What you'll find is that even though they're moving at 75% the speed of light, when you ask how fast is one coming with respect to the other, you'll find something less than the speed of light. It's pretty strange business, and I assure you I will give you homework problems with that in it, because it's just too weird to miss. You just really don't want to miss that. Okay, so before I get to that, all right, do you have any questions on any of this so far? All right, I'm going to stop right now to hand your exams back and come back to this at the start of class next time.